From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On November 18, 1978, in Guyana, Jim Jones and 908 others, nearly every member of his People's Temple, killed themselves. The Jonestown Massacre, as it's come to be called, was the deadliest mass suicide in modern history. Stanley Nelson's new documentary called Jonestown, The Life and Death of the People's Temple, reminds us that the People's Temple began as a utopian community that might very well have succeeded with a less troubled leader. The film opens this Friday at the Quad Cinema, and it has brought Stanley Nelson to my show today. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
One of the questions the film keeps on asking is, who was Jim Jones? Did you ever solve that mystery for yourself?
I think in some ways. I mean, he still kind of remains a mystery. One of the things that was essential to understanding Jim Jones for me was that we went back to his hometown, a small town, Lynn, Indiana, where he was from, and we actually were able to find some of his playmates who grew up with him and played with him when he was 5 or 6 years old. And they talk about how, you know, even at that young age, he had this fascination with death, and he was kind of a strange kid.
But he also was quite charismatic. I assume that didn't happen when he was very young.
No, I think you know, as he got older and gravitated towards religion, that's where he really started to gain a following, and you know, the charisma that's so evident later on in his life really came out.
What denomination did he join at the beginning?
He joined the Church of Christ, and actually
it's a Pentecostal group.
It's a Pentecostal group, and actually the People's Temple for all its time until they went to Guyana was really associated with the Church of Christ.
Although, as we see in the film, he became more and more secular. He was using religious style, to promote some ideas that had very little to do with religion.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's really fascinating about People's Temple and kind of drew me into the story was that, you know, Jim Jones had a way of drawing a really diverse group of people. So when you see the members of People's Temple, you know, you see old black people, you know, really, you know, up in the 80s and 90s, and you see elderly white people, then there's white, you know, hippies, and, you know, then there's young, you know, black militants with afros. And one of the things that always fascinated me was, you know, how and why did all these people gravitate to People's Temple?
But he also adopted the style of the black preachers. In fact, we have a little snippet here from the film, which unfortunately takes place late in the story in Guyana, but it'll give people some sense of how Jim Jones could preach.
If by any chance you would make a mistake to try to come in and take any one of us, we will not let you. You will die. You will have to take anybody over all of our dead bodies.
Love's the only weapon.
Bullshit. Martin Luther King died with love. Kennedy died talking about something he couldn't even understand, some kind of generalized love, and he never even backed it up. He shut down. Bullshit. Love is the only weapon with which I got to fight. I got a hell of a lot of weapons to fight. I got my claws. I got compasses. I got guns. I got dynamite. I got a hell of a lot.
Did he have that style when he started in Indiana?
Well, actually, we actually have a clip in the film from 1953, believe it or not, that we found of Jim Jones preaching that was almost, you know, like him speaking in tongues. It's just incredible. You can hardly understand. It's really quick. But then as he progressed, you know, in the 60s or so, as the church moved to California, he, you know, sounds like a black preacher. And that's what, you know, the People's Temple members that are in the film say is he sounded black.
And he made a strong commitment to integration from very early, he and his wife were the first white couple in Indiana to adopt an African-American child.
Right.
That must have been an act of bravery at that time.
No, it was. He actually adopted an African-American child who was about a month old. He named him Jim Jones Jr., even though Jim Jones had a biological son, but he named his adopted son Jim Jones Jr., and Jim Jones Jr. is in the film and has an incredible story to tell.
He was one of the people who didn't wind up dying as a result of the Kool-Aid, the poisoned Kool-Aid.
Yeah, that's one of the kind of misconceptions about People's Temple. There are a number of people who were part of People's Temple who just didn't happen to be there that day. So Jim Jones Jr. and a bunch of other people were on a basketball team that the church had, and they had a basketball game that day. So they didn't happen to be there, and they survived.
Did his social gospel and his commitment to integration lead them to leave Indiana and go to Ukiah, California?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that led to them leaving. I mean, I think this was an integrated church in the early middle 50s in Indianapolis, Indiana. And, you know, there was a lot of pressure on them. That was one of the reasons why they left. But they also left because there was an article in Esquire magazine that said Ukiah, California was one of the 9 places in the world that would survive in case there was a nuclear attack.
Part of the problem in dealing with him is his message often comes across as profoundly moral, decent, and then it's apparent that this guy's also a con man on some level, but he's not Elmer Gantry in every way, only in some ways.
And I think that's one of the things that makes him so exciting is such a great character and so different from what I had heard, you know, is that there is this message of his that's really good. You know, he's like, he's operating on 2 different levels throughout the whole history of the church and probably throughout his whole life. So there's this one level where the church is ascending. They're getting more and more members. They're getting more and more political power. But underneath is this real dysfunction and this real corruption and sexual corruption that wasn't known.
But it's that only starts really showing itself, at least as the film reveals, as he becomes something almost of a cult leader, as more and more people seem to deify him and the church moves away from focusing on God and more on its leader, Jim Jones, power seems to be corrupting him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that again, this was the guy. There's a story that one of his friends tells when he's a kid of him, you know, killing small animals so he could have funerals for them. This is that same guy. But as he gets more and more power and more strength, the corruption just becomes that much greater.
And then, like in cults, members had to forsake control over their lives when they entered the People's Church. They signed over all their worldly possessions. The church wound up owning all the houses and the like. Was he presenting that as some kind of a socialized situation?
Yeah, I mean, it was a form of socialism. And I think that one of the fantastic things, you know, about it, and one of the things that was really hard to grasp for me in making the film was that, you know, it did work for a long period of time. You know, he promised elderly people, well, you come in, you know, you give me your Social Security check, you know, you give me your welfare check, and I will take care of you. And he did that. And he did that in a much better way than they could have been taken care of otherwise. And so that's why it worked. That's why people flocked towards him.
But I remember speaking to a former member who told me that Jim was a saint because women would come to him and say, Jim, I'm going to leave the church unless you sleep with me. And he against his better judgment, would do that. In the film, you suggest that he often was dropping hints, and not just with women. He seemed to like everybody.
Yeah, he had sexual relationships with men and women, and there's some.
He offered himself to somebody. He said, if you ever want to have anal sex, I'm here for you.
Yeah, and he also has sex with a woman, and as she describes the whole time, he's telling her, well, I'm doing this for you. You know, he was a real character.
My guest is Stanley Nelson, whose film Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple, opens this Friday at the Quad Cinema in Greenwich Village. You have some stunning footage in this film. Where did you get that? Did they film all their services and other things that they did?
Well, you know, like so many groups that are doing things that they think are really fantastic and worthwhile, you know, like Nazi Germany, the People's Temple filmed and photographed and audio recorded everything that they did. And so, you know, there's actually an audio recording of that last day of him urging people to take the poison and of the men, women, and children screaming and dying. But we also found footage that some People's Temple members had in their closets that had never been shown to anybody before, that they had kind of just had and kept hidden. We also found a guy who shot in People's Temple over a couple of days in the early 70s, and he shot a healing ceremony. He shot Jim Jones preaching and some other things in the church.
He did faith healings.
Yeah.
You don't talk about this in the film, but I know I've spoken to other people about this. He would rot chicken livers, and then he would plop them down the throat of somebody, and they would gag it up,
yep.
And he'd say, mm-hmm. You had a cancer, and you've just spit it out.
Right. That was one of his great techniques that he would use to convince people that he could heal. In the film, we actually show him making a woman walk, and actually she runs up and down the aisles. We have an incredible scene where it's described from a woman who was there at the time.
And it turned out the woman had never had any problem walking.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to tell the whole film, but yes.
No, don't worry.
That was another
the
one.
The film is fascinating to watch. If you reveal a couple of those things, it's okay.
Right.
Well, he also he became a major political power broker in the Bay Area.
Yeah, that was something that you know, when I went into the film, I had no idea that Jim Jones was such a part of the political establishment in the San Francisco Bay Area. I mean, he helped get George Moscone elected, and for his role in getting Moscone elected, he was appointed as head of the Housing Authority in San Francisco.
And when did he start getting negative press?
You know, he didn't. You know, there started to be like little tiny things leaking out, and what happened was a guy, Marshall Kilduff, who's in the film, a reporter, was going to publish a big story in New West magazine that kind of exposed Jim Jones, and the editor called Jim Jones on the phone and said, you know, I better tell you what we're going to say, you know, in this article that's coming out tomorrow. Let me read it to you. And as she's reading the article, Jim Jones says to one of his followers, you know, get ready, we're leaving tonight. And that night they left for Guyana.
But they already had this thing set up in Guyana, so he must have been planning to leave for a while. Was he starting to feel pressures, or was it just that they wanted to try something even more radical?
Well, originally the plan for Guyana was that they would have kind of an outpost, a missionary outpost in Guyana, and that they would not all move to Guyana, that they would have kind of another facility in Guyana, and some people would go down there and some people would stay. But once this article was going to come out and Jim saw that he was going to be exposed and there were going to be major problems, that's when they said, you know, we're all going to Guyana.
And then people just picked up and left, almost all the members of the temple?
Yeah. Almost everybody left, and it was like overnight. I mean, you know, Jim Jones left that same night with his entourage, and then they started flying people down. There's stories in the film of people who just left their families. You know, their husband would come home, and his wife and the kids would just be gone.
How did they survive? Was this like a kibbutz?
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was kind of the idea. They were growing crops. You know, they had chickens and other animals. They weren't, you know, the food growing wasn't as successful as they wanted to be, so they were still having to import food. But they were still, you know, getting people's welfare checks and Social Security checks and other money was still coming to them down there. So they were still importing a good bit of food. But the final idea was that they would be self-supporting in Guyana. I should also say that you know, in Guyana, they were in the middle of nowhere. They were 250 miles from the major city in Guyana.
Did you go there?
No, I ended up not going there. We were going to go. You know, we had real plans of, you know, shooting kind of these evocative scenes of palm trees blowing in the breeze and going down there. But, you know, once we started to find the footage, and we actually found this so much footage of them in Guyana and of them interviewing each other and talking about, you know, their lives in Jonestown, that we realized that we didn't have to go. Also, the Guyanese government bulldozed Jonestown, and it was reclaimed by the jungle. So there's really not much left there now.
The soundtrack that you have was from a microphone that was under his throne. He had a throne.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he did. He had a throne.
Was this a complete? This just an absolute monarch here, or
yes.
Did he have other people who were also making decisions?
No, he made all the decisions. He made every single decision. You know, if you wanted to leave, if you wanted to go into the capital, Georgetown, because you know, for supplies or whatever, you had to get permission from Jim Jones. I mean, he had complete control of the community.
And weren't people troubled by this? Originally, it was presented as a kind of a total democracy.
Well, one thing that's really fascinating about People's Temple is that, you know, that you have Jim Jones who's kind of going mad, but for most of the people, you know, their day-to-day lives were not centered around Jim Jones. They were centered around the other People's Temple members.
Mm-hmm. Were there any warnings that a disaster of this sort might happen?
He had these rehearsals where he gave people poison, where he gave the congregation, you know, these drinks, and then he said, you know, that's poison that you've just drank. And he did this, you know, just to see their reactions, you know, to see if anybody would attack him, to see what they would do. And he did this, you know, a couple of times.
So that was just a power trip? You don't think that he was also thinking, you know, this may be an option somewhere down the line?
Oh, I think he definitely thought it was an option somewhere down the line. I mean, you know, you have to understand and remember that they did have the cyanide there. You know, and cyanide is not used for very much else. So, you know, it was something that was an option. I don't know if it was, you know, ever really planned of, you know, I'm going to do this on this day, but it was an option.
And then there's the visit from Congressman Lee Ryan, who goes there on a fact-finding mission? For what reason?
Yeah, Lee O'Ryan was a congressman from California, and some of his members of his constituency approached him and said, you know, our relatives are in Jonestown. We think they're being held prisoner. You got to investigate. So, you know, Lee O'Ryan was this kind of, you know, that kind of guy, and he goes down there with very little knowledge of what, you know, is going to lay in front of him, of who Jim Jones was and what People's Temple was.
But the big shocker is that they kill him. Now, he could have just gone back to California. This thing could have dragged on for a very long time. But it comes across as suddenly paranoia taking over.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it was. There's an incredible... There's incredible footage in the film because when Ryan goes down, he goes down with an NBC crew and they're filming the whole time. And so you see the night before the suicides, you know, the people in People's Temple in Jonestown, you know, they have this band with a horn section and they're singing Earth, Wind, and Fire songs and they're dancing and they're just as happy as they possibly can be. You know, and it looks like a real party, you know, like you're with 1,000 of your friends in the middle of the jungle and just partying all night long. And then by the next day, they're committing suicide. And, you know, it doesn't look like it's possible, but it is what happened.
But the suicide also strikes me as something of a contradiction because the People's Temple stressed commitment to life and not an afterlife. He dismissed the notion of an afterlife.
Right, he did. But it's also more of a contradiction, too, in that, you know, was it suicide or wasn't it suicide? You know, certainly there were 250 people there who were under 18. Certainly that was not suicide.
Well, and there were infants who were just given the poison. But what about others? I assume some people said, no, I just don't want to die. Were they forced? Were they coerced?
Well, as we have two people in the film who were actually there that day, and they talk about the fact that there were guns there. And so, you know, I think that there was some coercion.
Do you think that there was also a feeling for the people who did take it willingly that they were exiles who'd run out of options?
I think so. I mean, I think that they were also misinformed. I mean, Jim Jones was the only way that they got any kind of news down there. Jim Jones was on loudspeakers, you know, 24 hours a day, telling them that African Americans were being arrested in the United States, that they were building concentration camps, that this is what was going on. So, you know, they had no idea of what the real world was like. They were told that the army was coming down there to get them and to persecute them and to take their kids. So,
talking about going to the Soviet Union as an alternative.
Right. That was something that he promised. And one of the things that was really important for us in the film was to play this tape from the last day where Jim Jones says, okay, let's now take the poison. And this one woman gets up, this older black woman, and says, no. You know, what about the Soviet Union? You said we could go there. You know, isn't it more important that we stay alive and fight? And it's just, it's incredible back and forth between her and Jim Jones, you know, arguing about whether they should take the poison or not.
How do people you spoke to, like Jim Jones' son, explain the tragedy?
I think, you know, I think it really depends on the person. I think that there's as many different opinions as there are people.
But are there people that, who still are defending the People's Temple? I know I've met a few people who were in it who have come up with all sorts of explanations that exonerate Jim Jones.
I haven't found anybody, you know, at all. Nobody that we interviewed exonerated Jim Jones. I mean, they were all very clear that what he did was wrong and what he did was evil. But I think that all of them pretty much, you know, talk about how wonderful their time was in People's Temple, you know, aside from Jim Jones, that there was a lot of love, a lot of caring, and that they had found this community that they always dreamed of that they haven't been able to find since.
Well, this is another one of those stories of a utopian dream gone crazy. And yet you wonder whether it's possible for utopias ever to remain utopias.
You know, I mean, one thing that in making the film, you know, I really kept thinking was, you know, I hope it's possible. You know, I mean, hey, that's what a utopia is. I mean, we all want to live in a utopia. I mean, that's what it's all about. Unfortunately, I think that one of the things that was the result of the deaths in Jonestown was that from then on in, for a long time, these utopian communities have been associated with this kind of madness.
You received a MacArthur Award in 2002.
I sure did.
That has to make life a little easier when you want to make films that you believe in.
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, it's been an incredible award, an incredible pat on the back. But, you know, you never know why, you know, people fund your films or don't fund your films. You know, they don't say, you know, I'm funding your film because you got a MacArthur, or they don't say, I'm not funding your film because you're an idiot. You know, you get funded or you don't. I mean, I still have to raise money for films, and I'm very fortunate that we were able to raise money for this film and get it done, you know, in a couple of years and not spend, you know, 7-8 years on it as I have in the past.
Stanley Nelson's film, Jonestown, The Life and Death of the People's Temple, is opening this Friday at the Quad Cinema, and it includes music from the People's Temple Choir and also the Children's Choir. We'll go out with a little bit from those children, unfortunately, all of them dead.
Yeah.
Up next, Nobel Prize winner Wangari Maathai explains how rural women are working to improve Kenya's environment and economy by planting millions of trees, and also the impact that she and they have had on Kenya's political situation. I want to alert you to the fact that this Sunday, October 22nd, I'll be talking more with Wangari Maathai about the environment in Africa and beyond at the 92nd Street Y. That's at 7:30 p.m. For more information, you can visit our website at WNYC.org. This is WNYC and WNYC.org, New York Public Radio. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.